Okay, well, before this thing switches on, I can start by thanking David and the organizers for inviting me here. I have to start with perhaps a disappointment. I won't be talking about synchrony today, but I'm sure this issue will come up maybe during questions. This is an overall outline what I would like to talk about today, and I would like to subdivide my talk in two parts. Maybe we could have a break in between. In the first part, I would like to discuss how the visual cortex is able to detect connections between regions in the visual image. And this part of my talk will have as a subtitle, distinguishing between what I call two schemes of cortical computation. Two schemes being a first scheme, a feed-forward scheme, and the second scheme is a recurrent scheme. And then, after the break, I would like to discuss how more complicated cognitive operations are implemented in the visual cortex by what is sometimes called visual routines. Okay, these are the people of our team. So, this is Victor Lamy, with whom I collaborate in recording from Awake Monkeys. Then we have Paul Kayat here, who is a PhD student in my group, and he also works on Awake Monkeys, and you will see some data of his during the second part of my talk. This is Steven Scholte, who was involved in some of the psychophysics that I will show. Sander Botté, who is not on the slide, who did some of the computational work that I would like to discuss today. And Henk Spekrijzer, who is our keeper and who is the head of our department. Okay, so as I said, the first part of my talk I would like to devote to the question of how the visual cortex is able to detect connections among image regions. And I will go over some very introductory stuff about the visual cortex very quickly, because I'm quite sure that everybody knows that. But this is my most introductory slide. It shows how visual information reaches the cortex. Now, I'm not going to discuss all this. Main issue is here that this is the primary visual cortex, which is the first cortical stage of visual information processing, and I will be showing you a lot of data from this structure. Now, from the primary visual cortex, the information is relayed to a huge array of additional visual areas here in the occipital cortex. And one of the main questions that is of great interest to many people, including me, is what happens to visual information when it's being relayed or transferred from one area to the next. Now, we study this question to some extent in the monkey cortex. Now, this is a slide that I guess everybody has seen a zillion times. So, main point here for me is that information arrives here in the primary visual cortex, so this is the macaque brain, it's a lateral view. And then it is relayed to all these other visual areas. So all these different colors here correspond to a different visual area. But information first enters here, yes?
But I mean, not to play devil's advocate, but isn't there also input from the pulvinar into MT? I mean, is it fair to say that all the information enters first in V1?
No, it's not fair to say that. So there are alternative routes to the visual cortex. And this may come up during some later part of my talk, actually. But, I mean, this is kind of the first approximation scheme. So all information enters the primary visual cortex. And certainly, if you silence the primary visual cortex, you will see that activity declines drastically in the inferior temporal cortex. There are some parallel routes to the parietal cortex up here. Okay, but for me right now, the main message here from this slide is that there are many visual areas, and one of the questions is, what happens then to visual information when it's being exchanged between all these areas in order to arrive at visual perception? And how then do all these areas exchange information? Well, from the same authors, an equally famous slide. So all these areas are interconnected by a dense network of cortical-cortical connections. Now, information first enters here in the primary visual cortex, and is relayed to higher visual areas by way of feed-forward connections. However, as we all know, there is an equally dense network of connections that run in the opposite direction, the feedback connections. But it means that also activity that is here, a change in activity here, can in turn influence the activity at lower hierarchical levels. So we have feed-forward connections, feedback connections, and then there's a third type of connections that are between areas that are in the same hierarchical level. And these are called lateral connections.
So there's no direct projection from V1 to V2?
Oh yeah, this is V2, this whole thing. So these are all direct connections. So they are very heavily interconnected. The main point is that there are feed-forward connections, there are feedback connections. These two types of connections are actually equally dense. So now I'm then at the point to phrase what I call two schemes of cortical computation, and it's very simplistic in a way. So this is what I call the feed-forward scheme of cortical computation, and what I did is just include feed-forward connections. So all these white arrows correspond to feed-forward connections. Now information starts to arrive in the cortex, in the primary visual cortex, and here receptive fields are small, as we all know, and neurons are tuned to very simple features, such as the orientation of a light bar. Now in area V2, a single neuron receives information by way of this feed-forward connection from a couple of neurons in V1 that have displaced receptive fields. And as a consequence, the receptive field in area V2 can be somewhat larger, because it just can pull information over a somewhat larger region of visual space. Now something more happens in this feed-forward projection as to make tuning in area V2 also slightly more complex. And this is indicated here schematically by this curved edge. Now this scheme is reiterated over and over again, and by the time you reach the inferotemporal cortex, so this is a region that is thought to be involved in object recognition at a relatively high hierarchical level, you'll see that receptive fields have become very large and that tuning has become fairly complicated. Okay, now my recurrent scheme of cortical computation. And what I did is just, I added recurrent connections. And they come in two flavors. I added here, as red arrows, lateral, and in this case, lateral intra-aerial connections. And with blue arrows, I added the feedback connections. Now having these recurrent connections drastically influences the way that such a network may process information. And I will come to that in just a moment. For now, suffice to say, for instance, that if you have a neuron in area V2 that receives bottom-up input from its classical receptive field, this neuron can now also receive information from another V2 neuron that has a completely different receptive field. For instance, through a sequence of lateral connections or through a sequence of feed-forward and feedback connections. And therefore, now neurons can influence from outside the classical receptive field. And this is indicated here by this darker shaded region. But these recurrent connections have also an additional number of properties, and I'll come to that in just a moment. So for now then, I've phrased the two schemes of cortical computation, and since we know that these recurrent connections are there, you may now kind of object, well, why did you put on the feed-forward scheme of cortical computation in the first place? Because we know that all these other connections are there. And actually, I indeed would like to convince you that these recurrent connections play a role. But what I would now like to do is to provide you with an argument that suggests that if you don't have these recurrent connections, you can still achieve a lot in terms of cortical computation. Yes?
I mean, in principle, you can achieve any computation with purely feed-forward systems.
Exactly. That's the question. Thank you. So at least there's one person here who likes the feed-forward scheme of cortical computation. That's the point. Okay, should we skip this talk? and this argument that suggests that you can achieve a lot in terms of cortical computation if you only have the feed-forward connections, that's the argument. I think it was first brought up by, I think it was Oram and Parrott, and it later was reiterated by Toffee. And I would like to go into this to give you some impression of the argument. I think it's quite a nice argument. And this argument is based on data from the inferotemporal cortex. So in the inferotemporal cortex, It is the here the region in the macaque visual brain that is thought to be involved in object recognition. And this is from a study by Kobataka and Tanaka in 94. And what they did is they just entered electrodes here at this location in the cortex of a macaque. And then they had this library of everyday objects. And they then tried to select an object from this library that was with which they would be able to activate a neuron. And this particular neuron that is illustrated here, they came up with this monkey's face. And this shows you the response, or the PSTH. You can see that the neuron gave a pretty good response to this face of a monkey. But the next step that the authors took is to think whether it would be possible to reduce the complexity of the stimulus without losing the neuron's response. And then they came up with this smiley face. And you see that the response was even more vigorous to the smiley face. So then they tried to take the next step and try to reduce the complexity of the stimulus even further by removing the mouth. But now the neuron fell silent. And if they removed the eyes, again the neuron fell silent. And if they removed the outline, again the neuron fell silent. And there are some more examples here. So this then illustrates that these neurons in the inferior temporal cortex are indeed highly selective. They're selective to shapes or conjunctions of features in the correct spatial configuration.
How do you explain age?
Well, it seems that this neuron, at first sight, would like the eyes to be black. But of course, there are many, many explanations. That's not the point of this slide. So, now, this does not constrain the way in which you can achieve such a selectivity, but and it's not as clearly cannot as clearly be seen in this slide. But the typical or the earliest response latencies of neurons in this area are on the order of 70 to 80 milliseconds. And now it turns out that this puts a very huge constraint on the type of connections that you can use in order to achieve the selectivity, because you can see that the very first spikes are already informed about this complicated constellation of features. So only if everything is there, the very first spikes are fired. But if the mouth or the eyes or the outline is lacking, even the very first spikes are not fired by the neuron. So even these earlier spikes are highly tuned to this complex feature constellation. Now, how does this constrain then the connections that you can use to achieve the selectivity? Well, now we have to digress a little bit about latencies in various visual areas. So in area V1, if you present a high contrast image to a monkey, the earliest neurons start to fire at the latency of about 40 milliseconds. Now the earliest latencies in area V2 are typically about 10 milliseconds longer. But there's a 10 millisecond time difference between the earliest responses in V1 and V2. Now, we all know that the typical peak firing rates of neurons are on the order of 100 hertz. So that means that a typical interspike interval at maximum firing rate is 10 milliseconds. Now, this implies then that by the time that these first neurons in area V2 start to fire, neurons in area V1 have had the chance to fire typically 0 or 1 spikes. Now, clearly, there's not a lot of time for these recurrent interactions to do these lateral connections to do a lot. There's certainly no time for feedback connections to do something. Yes?
We just found a recurring network. It was spike. Actually, it turns out that you can use a recurring network to do a computation within a few spikes.
Yeah, a few spikes. But I mean,
1 or 3 then.
Yeah, that's the point. So by the time that these earliest neurons in V2 are driven.
That is using a recurrent connection, not just feedforward. It is actually the current network.
Yeah. We're very informal here. Maybe you should explain the underlying idea.
Okay. So this kind of argument has been reiterated over and over again against the recurrent network. So what they did is this. They designed a little recurrent network where we have a self-connection acceptation and a lateral inhibition. And if you analyze the spiking dynamics of network, you can find that depending on the parameters, the network can go to a winner take off state or other state. But focused on the winner take off state, you can find that actually if the winner is 5 to 1, then that's it. If the winner take off competition is done. Although every neuron can get input gets strong, but only the strongest neuron
the neuron gets some input spike, and one spike decides the computation already. But the electric connection is already used.
Okay.
Precisely because of that connection that enables the computation.
Yeah, I can understand that in some cases, if you drive to the extreme, and if you have the first spike here, shut up all the other neurons, that at least it has some influence at this, on this first sweep of activity through the cortex.
Yeah,
my point here is only that, of course, there's no time for feedback effects. That's obvious. There might be a little bit of time for these lateral, and that if there's indeed a winner take all that rapidly shuts up everybody in his neighborhood, then this may shape somewhat this first feed forward sweep of activity. And I'm not here to defend this argument. I just want to present this argument also to fight against it from another point of view. Okay.
Yes,
I think that if you say that if you say that the first sweep of activity is dominated by feed-forward connections and the selectivity of feed-forward connections. I don't think that I state too much here. Would you agree?
I'm just saying that the very first sweeps can actually use your connection. Not really, that they cannot use it.
Yeah,
But I mean, the argument you're making is been around for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to repeat this argument to see what we're up against.
I'm just saying there are counter examples.
Okay, so there are different ways to counter this argument. So then, if you can reiterate this argument, and by the time you are in V4 neurons start to fire after about 60 milliseconds, and neurons in the inferior temporal cortex, this is the region from which I showed you an example response, start to fire after about 70 milliseconds. And so if you carry on this argument, this means then that the first neurons here in posterior inferior temporal cortex, by the time that the earliest neurons start to fire, neurons in area V4 have had a chance to fire only a single spike, the earliest spikes here, which in turn could have only been informed by a single spike in area V2. The earliest ones, which in turn could have only been influenced by a single spike in area V1. So this really strongly constrains the type of connections that you can use during this feedforward sweep of activity. So indeed, I would agree to you, there is perhaps a bit of time for these lateral connections to do something, but there's obviously no time for these feedback connections.
Later.
Yeah.
The argument is based on the inter-spike interval or something like that?
Yeah.
Because population rate can, in principle, change on arbitrary timescale.
Yeah, sure.
So if the population response in V1 is 40 milliseconds, this wave can travel several times between V1 and V2 in this 10 millisecond interval. You see, if you have 1,000 neurons and they spike with each spike with the probability of, so you have only 1/10 of a spike per neuron, you still have 1/10 spike.
So what you're saying, that the situation is different if you have many neurons?
Yes, the population rate can change.
I mean, in this interval between 40 and 50 milliseconds, suppose that we take this really as an absolute picture. There's no V2 neuron that fires. There are only V1 neurons that fire.
In the whole population, only one neuron fires?
The point Klaus is trying to make is you chose the latency based on data from single cells.
Yes.
And what Klaus is trying to say, if you look at the entire population of cells, that
in this interval, it will still be true that there are no V2 neurons firing, although some V1 neurons are firing. So some V1 neurons are firing a single spike in this interval, and some V1 neurons are firing zero spikes in this interval. That's all I'm saying. So in this interval, that only V1 neurons are firing, obviously there is no feedback effect from V2 yet. And we've just heard there is a little bit possibility for lateral interactions within V1. That's it.
Well, I think we should say that maybe that's a little too literal, because there's some small fraction of V1 cells, V1 neurons that will fire before 40 milliseconds.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is just kind of a very limited view, but I just want to bring about the argument that I think that's good evidence. This is a very good argument. It suggests that this first feedforward sweep of activity that runs through the visual cortex is dominated by feedforward connections, and just tells us a lot about what feedforward connections can do for you in terms of neural computation. That's all I'm saying. Okay. So then, not everybody is as convinced as I was the first time I read this argument, but I think that what we have seen from this and from this argument that you can indeed achieve a lot in terms of computation if you just have feed-forward connections. And some of the authors of the original papers, like Aram and Parrott, and certainly Toffee, really went to the extreme by suggesting that almost everything that is interesting about vision is solved during this first feedforward sweep of activity through all the areas. And it's my aim now today to come up with a paradigm for which I think there's very good evidence from different sources that suggests that you cannot solve it easily in a feedforward network that needs to be embedded in our visual cortex. So in principle, I agree with Klaus, who says you can solve any problem if you can solve it in a recurrent network, also in a feedforward network. But if you try to implement this problem that I will be talking about, connectedness detection, it's really hard to do it in a feedforward network that needs to fit in our head.
So is the statement that the feedforward can solve anything is based on the modular perceptron kind of argument, or what kind of argument is that?
I come to that.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is then an outline of the first part of my talk. First, I will provide you with some computational arguments and suggest that there are things that are not that easy to compute in a feedforward network, and I will come up with the task of connectedness detection. Then I will go to physiology and indicate that when subjects, monkeys, have to solve this task, we have good evidence for recurrent processing. And in the third part of my talk, I will show you some psychophysical data that indicates that connectedness detection takes time, and this also implies that it is not solved in a feedforward way. So now I would like to revisit these two schemes of cortical computation once more to try to isolate the key differences between the two schemes, and this then will provide us with the tools to distinguish between the two schemes during the rest of my talk. So in the feedforward scheme of cortical computation, I define the classical receptive field of a neuron to be that region of visual space from which a neuron is informed by feedforward connections. So all of these neurons are kind of sitting on top of a pyramid of feedforward connections. If you go higher in the hierarchy, this pyramid becomes larger, so its base becomes also larger, and therefore their receptive fields become also larger. Okay? So, and of course, by definition, and this is perhaps a bit circular, In such a feedforward scheme of cortical computation, neurons cannot be influenced from outside the classical receptive field. So that's one of the key properties about this feedforward scheme of cortical computation. The second property is that once you present a stationary image and activity has reached a certain level, say area V2, and this neuron has fired a couple of spikes, if you have listened to those spikes, this neuron becomes a bit boring because by that time it will have conveyed everything it will ever convey to you about a stationary image. Such a neuron is just doing a very simple filtering operation on the inputs that it receives from bottom up. And the third property is that by the time that activity reaches the highest level of your feedforward network, at least for a stationary image, information processing is then basically over. There will not be a lot of interesting changes in your network as long as the image is stationary. Okay, all these things are not true for a recurrent network. So now neurons can be influenced from outside the classical receptive field through a sequence of lateral connections or through a sequence of feedforward and feedback connections. Moreover, neurons, of course, the first thing if you present a novel image, the first thing they will tell you is driven by these feedforward connections because they provide the shortest route from the retina to the cell. But it may take some additional time, some additional synaptic delays, before these recurrent influences start to affect the neuron. And this implies then that these neurons may convey different messages at different times. The first message being driven by the feedforward input, and later messages being influenced by these recurrent connections. And the final property of this scheme is that by the time that information reaches the highest hierarchical levels, of course, information processing need not be over, because there are many possibilities for recurrent loops in such a network.
Doesn't IT get information from other regions of the brain? IT is collecting information from lots of
Yeah. I mean, everything is connected to everything. But if you present a novel image to the retina, that's what I'm talking about, then the typical response latency in IT is 70 to 80 milliseconds. If you go anterior in IT, it's even a bit longer.
But to say that if it's feed forward, then just nothing would happen after 70 milliseconds, it doesn't necessarily hold, right? Because IT can still be receiving input from other regions of the brain.
Yes, that would be then a recurrent influence. That's what I'm saying, indeed. I agree.
Well, you're calling that a recurrent.
Yes, yeah. I mean, if you take this picture that I showed from Fellman and Finessen in a very literal sense, that it just means that this is how information gets to IT. And if there would only be feed-forward connections, then of course nothing can happen. But of course, IT neurons are influenced from many, many sources, also from top down, from the prefrontal cortex. And this I would call a recurrent influence. Yeah.
Can I just say exactly what you mean by latency?
Latency? Well, when I present.
Spontaneous time, right?
Yeah.
Time. So what's latency?
Latency is when I present a novel image on the screen at time zero. How long does it take for this novel information to reach the neuron? So when is its spontaneous firing rate affected by this new information? How long does it take? That's how I define latency.
Take the first significant effect, or we take the mean value?
There are many things to discuss how you define latency, but that's...
The recurrent system builds up some activity, and you say, this is the time the first spike appears due to the purely feed forward, then you're just tricking out the whole system in between, right?
Yes, yeah.
It could be that the beginning of the response tells you something. So you're taking the beginning of the response?
Yeah, and this is also important for this argument that was made by Toffi and Rawls and by Armin Perret. So what you see in IT is that if you take the earliest neurons and their earliest spikes, those spikes are already very, very much tuned. So it's not, as if you're looking like say... Yes, exactly. The beginning, the first spikes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're up against. I mean, I'm really convinced by the data. These spikes are already very tuned. Well, you need, of course, to make a PSTH. You have to present your stimulus 1,000 times and compare it to another stimulus. And then you can see the time at which or no stimulus, then you can see the time at which the neuron is for the first time influenced by this novel information. Okay. So, having then investigated the key differences between the schemes of cortical computation, I would now then like to discuss what I call connectedness detection. So here I present four different images, and it is your task, which is very simple, to tell me whether these two yellow squares are connected to each other or not. So here they are connected to each other, here they're not, and here they're connected once more. Now if you look carefully to the image, you see that the differences between those images are very subtle. So the only difference between this one is a single pixel that was shifted from here to here, thus breaking the connection. The single difference between those two images is again a single pixel that was shifted from here to here, again breaking the connection. Now here I combined these two changes. You can see that now the two yellow squares are connected once more, although through a different path. Now this kind of informally then suggests that in order to compute connectedness, we really have to kind of integrate very many local decisions. And this is kind of hand waving, but I think that this is what makes it very difficult to compute in a feed-forward network.
I'm not sure if this is even done in the visual system. For example, when I solve something like this, start to follow and see whether they're connected or not, and maybe higher level associative cortex can also participate in this operation.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this actually is solved, but now I'm really jumping ahead during my talk. But I think that this is not solved in a feed-forward network, and I think it's really solved in a very interactive way. So I actually would agree to that. But that is just intuition. I mean, I would now really like to go through this more in a more rigorous way. So, I mean, this problem of connectedness has actually already been studied by Minsky and Papert in the 60s. And at that time, we had perceptrons, which were very popular. And then Minsky and Papert showed, so perceptrons are basically just feed-forward networks composed of two layers, right? And Minsky and Papert were able to show that it's very inconvenient if you try to compute connectedness with such a perceptron. And at that time, that was really a big blow to the field of people who were interested in perceptrons. And so it really almost killed the field at that point. But of course, we have now, since the 80s, I think we have much better feed-forward networks and also much better ways to train these networks. So I think it's a valid question then to ask, what would happen if you try to train a feed-forward network to compute connectedness? And we try to do so, and this is what I call our naive approach. So we just thought, well, let's see what happens if you try to compute connectedness in a three-layer feed-forward network. So this was our approach. We had a single layer of input neurons. Two of these input neurons were, so to say, the yellow squares, and we wanted this network to compute whether there was a connection between those two yellow squares. And the second layer, we had a number of hidden units with as yet unspecified properties, and at the third level, we had just a single neuron, a decision neuron, and we wanted this neuron to be on when there was an image, when there was a path in the image between these two yellow squares, that is, when they were connected, and we wanted this decision unit to remain silent if there was no such connection. And the idea was then to play around with the number of hidden units and to see how many hidden units you need to solve this task, because this provides kind of a measure for the computational complexity of the task. So, and when we started to do so, we really played a lot with the number of hidden units, and we started, I think, with a retina that was 6 times 6 pixels large, or 8 times 8 pixels. And actually, we were really surprised, because we never could have this network learn the task. And we played around with many hidden units, but we just never succeeded in training the network. So at that point, we really didn't understand what was going on. Yes?
You presented all kinds of connected or not.
Yes, yeah, arbitrary. Exactly. So, I mean, there are many possible images here.
In the input, were two of the units more stable? Were the two yellows, where the network could try to start in yellow and find the other yellow?
Yeah, so the two yellow ones were always on, so to say. So that was not the source of variation. They were always kept at the same position. We wanted to see whether there was a connection between, say, coordinates 1, 9 and coordinates 8, 1 or something like that. Well, the decision unit sometimes was on, sometimes was off. So if the decision unit was on and there was indeed such a connection, we said, okay, this is a good response. And if the decision unit was off and there was such a connection, we said it was a bad response. So we just trained the network and with the backpropagation algorithm, like everybody does it. But nothing special about that. It's just there were two pre-designated points in the image, and we just wanted our whole network to compute whether between those two points there was connection or not. That's all.
So that seems it would be harder if it's, longer.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We come to that. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. I mean, the fact that your intuition that the decision time increases as the length of the path increases, that would actually be an argument against such a feed-forward network, because such a feed-forward network would expect it to solve the task in a fixed number of steps. Okay. Well, also that is not necessarily true, but
there is an obvious feed-forward solution. You just take every picture, specify it as yes or no, and then take these templates.
Come to that.
So
yes.
The input neurons, did they have three values?
Two values. And these yellow ones, they are just always on.
And then so the green ones came on. And
yeah, they are 0 or 1, basically. Yeah.
So that's not clear that the network never figure out what to do, right?
Yeah,
examples, for instance, so your first examples would have no yellow, right?
But they're always the yellow ones. They are always on. I think that your problem will be solved when I go on. So, I mean, in the beginning we were really not understanding what was going on here, but we just decided to reduce the complexity of the task by reducing the size of the input image. So we went to a retina 4x4 pixels, so 16 pixels. Two of them were yellow, so that leaves 14 pixels to be on or off, and these two yellow pixels were always on. And then we played around with the number of hidden units, and we then found that there was a critical number of 20. So if you put in 18 or 19 hidden units, the network could not solve the task, but if you put in 20 or more, the network would certainly converge and solve the task. So in the beginning, we were kind of intrigued what was so special about this number 20 on the 4x4 retina. And then we looked at what the hidden units had become tuned to, and that's shown in the next slide. So this shows you just an example of the image that we showed to our network. So here there is obviously a connection. And I would like to add also that this didn't count as a connection. So two neighboring pixels were only counted as directly connected if they shared an edge. And then now I'm showing you the receptive field properties of our 20 hidden units. And you can see what happens. Each of the hidden units had become tuned to an entire path running from one yellow square to the other one. Now, these paths have a special property, and we therefore call them principal paths, because this property is that it's not possible to remove any of these green squares without breaking the connection. And so this is clearly not a principal path, because you can remove this pixel, this pixel, this pixel, and this pixel, and then, of course, at some point, you will end up with one of these principal paths. And if you count the number of principal paths on the 4x4 retina, there are 20. So that explains now how our network had solved the task. And it's similar to what you said, but it's a bit more clever. Yeah, it's kind of a lookup table. So, I mean, what's going on here is that there are 20 hidden units. Each hidden unit kind of looks for a principal path. If there is one such principal path, one of the hidden units becomes active and tells the decision unit to also become active. But if there is no hidden unit that is active, the decision unit can safely assume that there is no connection between, because all these principal paths are enumerated by the network. And this enumeration of all principal paths, that is what makes it difficult on a larger retina. So it actually is the case that the number of principal paths grows exponentially with the size of the input image. And this shows you just an example of a principal path on an 8x8 retina. So they become very winding. And this then kind of illustrates that, or explains why we couldn't, we had a total failure in the beginning when we tried to train our network to solve this task on larger retina.
Did you change the temperature of the gain function at all? Because this is a low temperature
I don't remember the details of how we did this, and I call this our naive approach, so I don't have very strong feelings about this, but I just want to give as a general message that it's not trivial to compute connectedness in a feedforward network. Now, this is a three-layer feedforward network, and you may kind of object that, of course, in the visual cortex you have more than three layers. So it could well be that if you have more than three layers, that to solve this problem becomes much easier. And actually, this is indeed the case. And I looked in the literature, and the best algorithms that can solve this problem in a feedforward way, they still need at least a square of the sampling resolution. Now, if you take as a first approximation of the sampling resolution in human vision, that would be the number of axons in the optic nerve, which is 10 to the power 6. The square of that, of course, is too many neurons that you would like to set aside to solve this relatively trivial problem. But even for these multilayered feedforward networks, there's one problem that remains, and that is illustrated here. So suppose that we have a multilayered feedforward network, and at some level of our network, say level n, we want the network to compute whether there is a connection between pixel 1 and pixel 2. Now, what do we compute? What do we want to compute at a lower level? Well, the obvious candidate is to look for another location, say pixel 3, and to see whether there's a connection between pixel 1 and pixel 3, and whether there's a connection between pixel 2 and pixel 3, and combine these two pieces of information at level n of a network. Okay, this is illustrated here. However, if I now take another image, in this image, we actually would like, perhaps, to have the detector for a connection between pixel 1 and pixel 2 to be at a lower level than the detector for a connection between pixel 1 and pixel 3, at least in the feedforward network. And this then shows you, again, another example of that. So it indeed seems to be the case that there, if you try to decompose connectedness detection in this way, in simpler subproblems, there seems to be a difficulty, a kind of an inherent seriality in the problem. And this is also true for these multi-layered feedforward networks. And that, I think, explains why it is not easy to come up with an algorithm that does it with fewer neurons than the square of the sampling resolution. Although, of course, I'm not here to say that's completely impossible. I just say maybe somebody in the audience or somebody in a few years will find a better way to do it. But at least I hope to have to convince you that it's not easy to solve this problem, or not trivial to solve this problem with a feedforward network. Now, at this point, you may then want to object that you may buy all this, but you may say, well, perhaps this problem of connectedness detection is not really a problem of everyday vision. It could be kind of an academic problem. So in order to counter that argument, in the next slide, I took 7 everyday objects that are composed of several parts. And of course, in everyday vision, these parts are connected to each other. But here I kind of broke the connections just for illustrative purposes. So now the question to the audience is, which are the 7 objects? So please speak out loud.
Vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, it's a vacuum cleaner. Yeah.
Hammer.
A hammer, yes.
Umbrella, maybe.
Umbrella. Where is the umbrella?
Suitcase.
A suitcase, yes.
Is that a scissors?
Yeah, scissors, yeah.
Dental floss?
Sorry? Dental floss. Now this actually belongs to the vacuum cleaner, which is kind of a long thing.
There's chopsticks.
Chopsticks. Yeah, this actually is a part of the scissors.
Oh,
more chopsticks here. Okay. That. So you can see you can spend some time looking. Sorry? Circle? Okay, well, you can see you can spend some time looking at this slide. And in the next slide, then I kind of reestablish the connections that are usually there. And you can see that the task is much easier. So this then informally demonstrates that it's indeed this connectedness property is something that is really of importance to us. Yes?
The other case was connectedness per se. Here we have patterns which are quite stereotyped and which don't have the inherent properties which you had in the first thing.
Yeah, I'm saying here is that connectedness is one of the cues that helps us to group the image, and image segmentation is of course very important for things that are as important to us as object recognition. I'm not saying more. Okay, almost. Okay, well, it's an informal demonstration, but it suggests really to you that it's not an academic problem. Now, at this point, I could say, well, this is it. But of course, because what I've indicated is that connectedness is something that is not easy to solve in a feedforward architecture, and that's not an academic problem. But of course, you might want to know then how having these recurrent connections help to solve the problem. And actually, it's very, very simple to devise algorithms if you have recurrent connections that can compute connectedness for you. Sorry, can you say it again? You move your eyes across the image.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very well possible. Yeah, but that is not really, I think, something against the argument. I mean, you can remove your eyes if there are connections or if there's no connections.
No, I'm not saying that the problem is not. I'm just saying we don't solve the problem based on just one image.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah.
Based on the sequence of images.
Do you mean with sequence of images?
You move the eye, you get a different image.
To kind of interpret this image, you move your eyes first here, then here, then here. And all these objects are perhaps extracted one or a few at a time.
Because you have many images to work with. Every time you move the eyes,
you Yeah, sure. Yeah. I come to I think that if you would force a subject to fix it here, that he would still do a pretty good job. No, it's possible. I think the cortex can do it, but it's not the most natural way. So now, how do these recurrent connections then aid? And I said it's very easy to come up with a recurrent algorithm that solves this task. And this is just one version of such an algorithm. So the idea is then to have a single retinotopic map. So what I do is just reserve a single neuron for each pixel in the image. And of course, of these neurons, some of them are activated by the bottom-up input. These are the ones that are indicated in green. So for instance, this neuron is activated by this pixel, this neuron by this pixel, and so on. And now let's put in the recurrent connections. And what I need here is just nearest neighbor connections. So each neuron here is connected to its four nearest neighbors. And now the idea of this recurrent algorithm is to spread a label through the network. And there's a very simple rule to the label spreading, and that is that the label may only be spread among neurons that are activated by bottom-up, that are activated directly by the image. And this simple rule then subdivides all connections in two classes. The first class of connections have at least on one side a neuron that is not activated by the image. So these are kind of disabled connections. And the second class are then the enabled connections. And I sometimes call this the interaction skeleton. Now the idea is then to insert a label at step one among one of these neurons that have been activated by the image. And then it's easy to see that in time, this label will spread to precisely those neurons that respond to pixels that are connected to the pixel where label spreading was initiated. So this really can solve the task. It's a very simple algorithm. Now what happens then if we make a subtle change to the image that is illustrated here? So what I do here is shift the pixel from here to here. So this kind of deactivates this neuron. It activates this neuron, and thereby two connections are disabled, two other connections are enabled. And it's easy to see that also for this image, in time, the label will spread precisely those neurons that respond to pixels that are connected to the pixel where label spreading was initiated. And this also then illustrates two of the properties of these recurrent networks that I alluded to in the beginning of my talk. First of all, it shows now that neurons can be influenced by information that is outside their classical receptive field. Because this neuron here will receive a label for this image, but it will not receive the label for this image. But the difference between the two images is actually here, so really remote from its classical receptive field, because the classical receptive field was just a single pixel from which it was activated by feed-forward input. The second property is that neurons may now convey different messages at different times, because the first thing that this neuron tells you is whether there's something in its classical receptive field. And then it takes some additional time before it will tell you whether it belongs to the subset of pixels that will be eventually be labeled or not. So different messages at different times.
Sometimes it sounds a little like a computer algorithm, not a neural
network. Yeah, but I will show you. I try to convince you that this is actually implemented in the visual cortex. So there's one thing that is lacking from this slide, and that would also add to biological plausibility, and that is what could be the identity of such a label. And I would like to convince you today that the label that's being spread through the interaction skeleton, or through this network of enabled connections, is an enhancement of neuronal responses. And that's illustrated here. So the idea is then that neurons that are not activated by bottom-up, they just have their spontaneous firing. Neurons that have something in their receptive field, they have a visual response. And neurons that, on top of that, also receive the label, they have an enhanced neuronal response.
So it's not synchrony anymore?
Not synchrony, no. We can discuss that if you want. But I really looked for that.
How do you decide on the label?
So the label is an enhancement of neuronal responses.
I know, but how did you decide that yellow one got labeled and the green one did not get labeled?
How I started, why I selected this pixel for a start? Is that
the
question?
The two N ones are labeled and then they spread the label. So it's
No, only one. In the beginning, only one is labeled.
You're saying oh,
yeah,
you
sure,
die
I didn't know that.
And you let it percolate all of it.
Yeah.
And if it reaches there,
that's
it gets yellow.
Exactly, yeah. So the label might be then an enhancement of neuronal responses. Now, to investigate whether such an algorithm is indeed implemented in
binary type of yes, no type of
yes.
What means enhancement? I mean, is it a fixed record here? Is it a threshold or probability of being connected?
At this point, this is just. It could be like instead of 10 spikes a second, 20 spikes a second. Of course, this is not yet biology. So we will go into biology now. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you do
a
time course on each
place. Yes.
What do you mean by that? How would you have a time course?
Right. Time zero. There's just a blank screen. Mm-hmm. Oh no! At time minus 10. There's a blank screen. At time zero, the image appears. And then the first thing, it say at time two, the neurons will be informed about whether there's something in their receptive field or not, by bottom up. And then depending on the distance between where the label is initiated and the receptive field of the neuron that you're recording from, it may take a different amount of time before this neuron tells you where it belongs, whether it may take different time before this neuron will start to express the label or not. These two? Well, perhaps because maybe in this is a very late one, so actually it should have a different bin here. This is just this maybe not a perfect slide. I mean, but of course, if you say that one bin is like 20 time steps, then it could well be that by the 40th time step this one has received a label, but by the 20th time step it has not yet received a label. Okay. This is how you could read this slide. So the first thing that the neuron tells you is whether there's something in its receptive field, and then you have to wait a little bit, and then the neuron may tell you whether it belongs or whether it should be labeled, or whether it belongs to the connected subset that is currently being labeled. Okay?
But the task was to see two pixels that are connected.
Yes. So it's a slightly different task. So in that case, you could kind of see whether the second pixel gets the label or not. That would be then a solution to that task.
So you could take the lower path and switch the last connection, the top left connection.
Here.
No, top left.
Here.
Yeah. You would switch that connection off.
Yeah.
And then compare the six white histograms for the two paths.
They should be the same. If I could this connection. Then they will be exactly the same, because the label that you inject here would never end up here.
So you have a yellow path.
Let's go back to the last slide. Maybe it's easier to see here.
No, it's
really... Oh, I'm sorry.
So you start with a yellow one, and the yellow goes and says, "Am I talking to my neighbor?" And there's the neighbor getting the bottom
up.
Now this is the start point. So I inject it here, nothing is labeled. Then I decide, well, let's take one of the neurons, say this one. And then in time, it will propagate across this thing. Now, Misha asked is, well, how do I then solve the task, or the question, the task of answering the question, are these two particular pixels connected? Say this pixel and this pixel. Then I just insert a label in one of these two pixels and wait a little bit and see whether it ends up at the other pixel. That would be a way to solve that task.
So on the first pixel, you have before you switch it back. You have a little white line connecting the right post white histogram to the green.
This one, you mean?
Yes. Does that mean that the signal started there?
No, it started here.
So probably that one would be activated high in the beginning.
Yeah, this is just the end result. So I start, yeah.
Be activated a little later, and then finally after 30 whatever milliseconds, the bottom one's activated. Then you ask the question, are the first guy and the last guy activated? And if they are, then it's connected.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So to see whether such a thing is indeed also implemented in the visual cortex, we decided to train monkeys on a task that requires connectedness detection. And this task is actually known to most of us, and it's called curve tracing. So if you want to know what Cookie Monster will be eating here, you will typically have to follow this path and see how it runs through the visual field. Now, in this version of the task, you will actually make a number of eye movements along this curve that needs to be followed. And actually, yes? Sorry?
He's eating the guy on the right.
So, we study a version of this test that can be solved without making eye movements. And then it's sometimes called mental curve tracing. So imagine fixating here and mentally tracing along this curve. You can do this for some length of curve. Perhaps it would not suffice to solve the entire task. So this is the task that we train our monkeys on. So they are facing a computer monitor. In the beginning, there's a fixation dot. That is where they have to look. Then after a short delay, there's a stimulus that looks like this. It's composed of two red circles and two curves. Now one of these curves connects one of these red circles to the fixation point, and I'll refer to this curve as target curve. And the other red circle is also connected to a curve, but this one is not connected to the fixation point, and I'll refer to this curve as distractor. Then after a delay of 600 milliseconds, the fixation point is removed from the screen, and now the monkey has to make an eye movement. Now, he can make an eye movement to one of these red circles, but he's only rewarded if he chooses the circle that had previously been connected to the fixation point. And I would like to emphasize, I'm going to show you recordings from the primary visual cortex, area V1, but these recordings that I will show you are always from this episode. So in this episode, the monkey is still maintaining fixation here. He's not yet moving his eyes, but he's mentally tracing the curve. He's thinking about the stimulus, but he's not yet moving his eyes. And once the monkeys learn this task, and actually it's not a very difficult task for monkeys, then once they've learned it, we implant electrodes chronically in the primary visual cortex, and through these electrodes, we then obtain multi-unit activity. So this is kind of the total activity of a cluster of neurons that are in the vicinity of your electrode. It's not a single neuron. It's like perhaps 10 or 20 neurons, or 5, it depends. Usually we don't know. Okay, so this then shows you an example of such a recording during this task. And this green rectangle shows you the receptive field of such a group of cells. And you can see that the receptive field here falls on the target curve, that is, on the path from the fixation point to the correct target for an eye movement, here it falls on the distractor curve. You can also see that what is inside the classical receptive field is absolutely identical for the two stimuli. Nevertheless, the neurons were influenced by this difference. When the receptive field is on the target curve, that's the response that is shown in yellow, the response was stronger then when the receptive field is on the distractor curve, which is the response shown in red.
I mean, it's just like touchy data. I mean, do you do like a kind of SK statistics or something? Is this very significant?
These effects typically are significant beyond reasonable. I mean, like 10 to the power minus 6 or so. We'd usually do a Wilcoxon test for that. And you just look at the distribution of firing rates for this stimulus, the distribution of firing rates of this stimulus. And if you record from a single group of neurons and you just look in a single trial, there are some neurons that allow you to distinguish between the two cases with a probability of 0.9. But it means that if you would only listen to this to this neurons on a single trial, you would be able to do correctly on this task on about 90% of trials. So these differences are really highly robust.
With one cell?
Well, one group of cells, one recording. One trial, one recording.
This is
V1? V1. So people are usually kind of distracted by the fact that it looks like a subtle modulation. And it's usually is subtle if you compare it to the peak response. But I would like to emphasize that by the time that you see these modulations, that these peak responses are no longer there. So if V1 is involved in processing at this point in time, this is the type of activity that you can expect there.
And they are on the world, right?
Yeah, and let me now go through a slide a bit more.
You said the classical receptor field has the same signal.
Yes.
How do you know? I mean, how do you know that there are no further feedforward connections extending beyond this?
Yeah. That's a good question. So the first question actually is, how do we map the receptive field? We map it with moving light bars. And on the basis of what is known from anatomy, the feed-forward connections from the retina to the LGN, to the primary visual cortex, and what is known about kind of the projections of the axonic arbors, there are very little neurons that can receive feed-forward input from a region that is larger than, say, 2 degrees. In V1, and it depends, of course, on the eccentricity from which you record. But if you would look into the literature, and actually these effects extend up to 10 degrees, and they actually don't fall off with distance. Yes. For this. No. Before I do this task, the first thing I do is map out the classical receptive field with moving light bars. So this tells me where is the classical receptive field. So I know that if I move a light bar in this region, then I will never be able to evoke a response from the cell. Not even a subtle blitch or whatever.
There's a couple of things that are a little bothersome by your statement. I mean, when people map receptive fields, not with light bars, but with dots, and just like a Larry Palmer kind of map, where you get a receptive field that falls out smoothly. And the other thing is, if I remember correctly, Kevin Martin and his associates have data where they look at the layer 4 cells and they look at the authorization of the dendrites, and you really see authorizations go off to the sides. And that, without doubting the data, It seems that at least at the level of layer 4, or 4 beta, you receive input from regions that you might say would be outside the classical receptive field. I mean, it's a funny statement to say you don't get any spikes, because then there's also this sort of ancient effect, this McElwain effect, right, that you could wave your hand anywhere in the receptive field and you get a couple of spikes. From any neuron. I mean, these sort of extra classical fields are
but
kind of ancient.
I would like to add on that these extra classical receptive field influences typically start about 40 milliseconds later than the spikes that you can evoke from the receptive field. So I think this is good evidence that this is actually based on recurrent connections that eventually also feeding it into a V1 neuron. Now you don't see a lot of that, so you see perhaps one spike difference, because if there's nothing in the classical receptive field, these connections don't do a lot on the response of a cell, but you can only see robust effects, as in this case, when there is really something in the classical receptive field that drives the cell.
You know, classical receptive field is found in the I coordinate, that's the eye of things, and then you...
Yes.
Now, here the monkey makes the cat.
No. That's why I emphasize that. He's fixating here all the time. He's only thinking about the stimulus. He's not yet moving his eyes. So here the stimulus, maybe I should say it a bit clearer. Here there's nothing on the screen, only a fixation point. Here the stimulus appears, but the monkey has to maintain fixation for 600 milliseconds. Here the fixation point is removed from the screen, and only in this interval he's allowed to make an eye movement.
So the monkey should decide where to go exactly. Even before he moves his eyes.
Yes, of course. I mean, you can only decide before you move your eyes. That's the only... Even if he was allowed to make his eye movement as soon as possible, he first has to think about the stimulus before he can choose where to move his eyes.
I just have another question about the data, if you don't mind. So let me just look at the guy on the left that's already been addressed. So if I look at one trace, it's wiggling, right?
This is not untraced. This is the average of like 100 responses.
I look at the average of 100 responses and I look at that top trace, and it seems this. Do you consider that wiggly stuff?
Presumably noise, yeah, yeah.
Okay, then it's funny that the two peaks line up better than.
Oh, yeah, that's my next point. That's my next point, so thank you. So I think that this illustrates two of the properties of these recurrent networks that I outlined. The first one, that is that neurons are indeed influenced from outside the classical receptive field, because what was inside the classical receptive field was absolutely the same for the two stimulus configurations. And the second point is that neurons convey different messages at different times. So the first thing that happens when something appears in the receptive field is that this neuron will be activated, and it will only be informed what is inside the classical receptive field. Well, this happens to be the same for the two stimulus configurations. And it takes some additional time before these recurrent influences start to be visible in the neuron's response. And this typically takes about 140 milliseconds. So you typically see the first response after about 40 milliseconds, then you have to wait like 100 milliseconds longer before you see these recurrent influences, at least during this task.
What's the
Well, I think I smoothed the data with something like 30 milliseconds.
Just surprised that they really you would expect to have some noise.
Here. Well, there might be an orange pixel here. So, I mean, usually they don't overlap precisely, but this is an average of like 100 responses. So it's not a big surprise that they overlap so well. It's not the case that I normalized here or so. It's really, If there would have been a difference here, you would have seen it in the slide. But this shows you then the second example. So here, the stimuli are just the curves are crossing each other. Here it's on the target curve, response in yellow. And again, the response is stronger than when the receptive field is on the distractor curve.
Even in the case on the right, I mean, there's only a little bit of pre-stimulus baseline. Which there's something fishy because the
baseline here
seems to match up very well, but then I look at the tailing edge.
Yeah, this is when the monkey is making eye movements.
And the variability there should be,
Here's when he's making eye movements. He's making eye movements. So you don't.
What you're saying is that's not a fluctuation. That those sort of detailed time course.
Oh well, I mean, imagine monkey making an eye movement to here, or making an eye movement to here. The during the eye movement, is in this part, the trajectory of the receptor field will be different for the two stimuli, so you expect the responses to be slightly different in this epoch.
I can't remember really what, but I started talking in the neuroscience conference, and they showed that the final factor for the first response is far smaller than later on. So it seems that the number of spikes you get in the first, 24 milliseconds is much more, has less fluctuation.
Okay, so I stand corrected.
I mean, this is really a very reproducible effect. So it's really nothing fishy about it. Okay, so yes. Yes. Exactly. That's my point.
It does not have to be the current coming from
the beginning. Exactly. I don't know. That's a good point.
Now, can we have latency like in this kind of plot?
So there are actually two latencies. The first one is when the neurons start to fire. They are driven by their.
This bar is the time you start to show.
Yes, that's this bar.
So then what's the latency?
Typically it's like 40 milliseconds. That doesn't depend on the task. It's just you present something to a V1 neuron, it will typically start to fire. Some start to fire after 40 milliseconds, but there are also ones that start to fire after 70 milliseconds. It's not the time that I stop to show the stimulus. No, it's the time. This is when. So here the monkey is fixating. He's only seeing a red dot, nothing more. And then here, the whole stimulus appears at once. And so something now strikes the receptive field. That causes the initial response transient.
So what's the latency?
This latency. Typically it's like 40 milliseconds.
From that vertical line to where is the latency?
From here to here. So, I mean, I smooth the data here with like 30 milliseconds. So that's why. But I mean, these differences don't depend on smoothing. If you just look at, I already said that. If you look at.
You don't just count spikes in the beam.
No.
You do some processing.
Here, no, I count spikes in the bins. But so I count spikes in the bins, and then I apply a smoothing window of 30 milliseconds. But I mean that means that just explains why the latency is not. I mean, this doesn't seem like 40 milliseconds. But it means that points like this distance away from each other are really uncorrelated. Mm-hmm. So these effects that you're seeing are very robust and very real. Yes.
So do you know the receptor field more toward the endpoint?
Oh yeah, that's good question. Yeah.
It's a long delay before.
Yeah. So this really requires a relatively long answer, because you might expect then if the receptor field is up here, you see an early modulation. So now we're talking about the onset of this difference. And the receptor field is down here, you would expect to see a later modulation on the basis of how I described the algorithm. Now, this is true, but not always. So it is true if you have these curves very close together. So if the monkey really has to make a very local, very complicated decision here of whether to kind of turn to the left or turn to the, like, here turn to the right, then you see that modulation here occurs much earlier than here. But if you have a stimulus in which the two curves are separated by a large distance, then, and there's also some variation among neurons when they start to express this modulation. So then it may happen that if the task is easy, that a neuron here starts to express the effect like after 160 milliseconds, but another neuron here starts to express the effect after 170 milliseconds. So you only see this, what you might predict, this kind of enhancement of latencies along the curve if you make the task difficult to the monkey.
For the same neuron, you could just shift the whole image along this curve so that you would get different latencies.
Yes, well, in this version of the task, the monkey is fixating here, yeah, and the task is to say which of the curves is connected to the fixation point. In that version of the task, that what you're saying is not possible.
No,
but it would be possible. But you never can manipulate this distance between the fixation point and the receptive field.
Why?
Because it's in retinal coordinates. So if you know where the fovea of the monkey is, then you know where its receptive field is. But it's an interesting question, and there are perhaps ways to do that, but we haven't done that so far. Excuse me? Yes. Yeah, even if it's 50 milliseconds, they can do it. Actually, I do. I looked at that. No, I mean, but if I present a stimulus for 50 milliseconds, so you get a transient response, but it's not if after these 50 milliseconds I switch off the stimulus, that the neuron is down here. These neurons have kind of, they gradually go back to zero. And in this tail, you see then the effect that I was talking about.
So this happens after the stimulus is already...
In that case, it's kind of an artificial case. Then you see the effect. The neuron is still responding. It's in its tail, and it shows the modulation. Yeah. Okay, this shows you just another example of this type of data. So here, we recorded from five groups of neurons. So you get five different receptive fields that are all shown here. And the receptive fields of neurons that had a significant enhancement of their response have been shown in yellow. And those that had a relative suppression are shown in gray. And you can see that for each of the four stimulus configurations, those neurons that had their receptive field on the target curve, they had a stronger response than those that had the receptive field on the destructor curve. No, this is just a single example from this receptive field. So this is the case here, this is the case here. And even if the two curves intersected each other, you got an enhancement of responses along the curve that needed to be traced. So it indeed seems to be the case then that during this task, the representation of an entire curve lights up in the primary visual cortex. So it's indeed this I think is good evidence for the idea that indeed such a label is being spread to and reaches all these neurons that respond to all those parts of the image that belong to a connected component. Yes. Yes. Two?
So, okay, that's fine. So if you add the animal, actually have to make this, the task after, say, 200 milliseconds, so before you actually see a difference in spiking. Like, if you turn the stimulus on,
yes,
and then you turn the stimulus off,
yeah,
at a certain point, and then, yeah. So suppose you turned it off after 200 milliseconds, so it actually didn't get this too short a time to have this difference in spiking in
mm-hmm. your mind.
Can the animal still do the task behaviorally?
Yes, that was the question that he asked.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah. So what you then see also, you also see an effect in V1, because if you present the stimulus for a short time, like 50 milliseconds, you see this response transient, but in this decay to zero, I mean, this decay to zero takes like 300 milliseconds or 400 milliseconds, so there is still kind of difference that you see then in the V1 response. Oh, you're asking what the reaction times is when I press the monkey to respond as soon as possible.
Right.
Then I get there is, if I really push him to go as fast as he can, I get the average reaction times on the order of 250 milliseconds. So before I really see the effect typically occurs after 135 milliseconds. So there's actually plenty of time to inform superior colliculus, frontal eye fields.
So the animal can't perform, the performance of the animal is always long enough.
Yes.
To in principle get a certain amount of
exactly.
differential.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Although in principle, I mean, just because the information took 250 milliseconds or whatever, 200 milliseconds to turn right down to V1, if the behavioral response was determined higher up, it could have already.
Yes, in principle. No, I don't have any strong data that suggests that this activity in V1 is related, or is actually involved in planning the eye movement. I'm only at this point I can only say it's early enough to do something interesting. It's not as if the whole task is solved by the monkey and only then V1 is informed about what was decided or something like that. But I don't have direct evidence that V1 is involved. I do have. I think that it would be very useful for V1 to be involved if these curves are very close together. Because if you think about such a label spreading algorithm, to do it with good enough accuracy, you need not translationally invariant receptor fields that are fairly small to carry out this labeling operation with sufficient spatial resolution. But I don't have direct data that suggests that V1 does the job. I don't believe that V1 is the only one who does it. So, such rate modulations that we observe during this task curve tracing have also been observed in other studies. And they have typically been attributed to visual attention. Now, I would like to convince you that what we see in V1 is also a correlate of visual attention. So, in physiological terms, I'm saying that during this task, spatially separate segments of a curve that needs to be traced are labeled with an enhanced neuronal response. I could rephrase this in psychological terms by saying that spatially separate segments of a curve that needs to be traced are labeled with visual attention. And in order to investigate this question, whether this is related to visual attention, I will now briefly show you some psychophysical data from human observers doing a similar task. So this is the task that we used in human observers. They had to fixate a point. They saw one of these 8 stimuli at a time, so only one at a time. They had to fixate here, and they had to press a button in their left hand if this left target was connected to the fixation point, and a button in their right hand if the right target was connected to the fixation point. And in the meantime, they had to maintain fixation, so they also had to do a mental curve tracing. They were not allowed to move their eyes, and this was checked. So in this particular study, we varied the stimuli at 3 different locations, and these are indicated here by these yellow circles, and I call these locations critical zones. So in the upper critical zone, the fixation dot could be connected to the left or to the right curve. In the middle critical zone, there could be an intersection or no intersection, and in the lower critical zone, there could also be an intersection or not. Now, the permutations then give rise to 8 different stimuli that are all shown here, and we grouped responses to stimuli that were mirror images. So we then have 4 stimulus categories. In the first category, there are 0 intersections. In the second category, there is a single intersection at the lower position. In the third category, there is a single intersection at the upper position. And in the fourth category, there are 2 intersections. And the first thing we did is just record reaction times to button press. And that is shown here. So what you see is that the reaction time strongly depends on the number of intersections. So if there are 0 intersections, reaction times are like 460 milliseconds. If there's a single intersection, reaction time increases by about 80 milliseconds. And if there are 2 intersections, reaction time increases by about 200 milliseconds. Now, I would like to argue that this is psychophysical evidence for the recurrent scheme of cortical computation. Because I argued that this feedforward sweep reaches the highest cortical levels at a latency of about 100 to 120 milliseconds. Now, if this would be the only thing that happens during this task, it's completely incomprehensible where an additional delay of 200 milliseconds could come from. Now, such a pattern of reaction time in the psychological literature is often taken as evidence for the involvement of visual attention. And I would also try to convince you that this is also related to visual attention, but actually, on the basis of the physiology, we have a much stronger prediction. The prediction is that attention should not only be involved, but we also predict where it should be directed. And it should be directed to all segments that belong to the target curve. Now note that there are also some segments that belong to the target curve that are, and by themselves are not all that interesting for the task. These are the segments that are outside the critical zones. These segments are identical for all 8 stimuli. So by themselves, they don't convey any information. But nevertheless, on the basis of the physiology, I would predict that attention is also directed to those segments that are outside the critical zones as long as they belong to the target curve. And this is something that we decided to test by doing an additional psychophysical experiment in human observers. And we used what is called a dual task design. It's illustrated here. So now our subjects have to do 2 tasks at the same time. Their primary task is just a curve tracing task. So this is the event. So it starts with a fixation point, then a stimulus appears looking like this. And it's their primary task to press a button in the left or right hand. So in this particular case, they would have to press a button in the left hand because this is the target that is connected to the fixation point. You also may see that some of these segments received a color, but these colors were actually completely irrelevant during the primary task. You can also see that these colors were outside the critical zone, so they were on segments that were identical for all 8 stimuli. Now, after the subject had pressed in the primary task, there was a mask, masking away the colors. And then there was an image appearing like this with a marker next to one of these segments that had previously had a color. And it was a secondary task of the subject to report the color that had previously appeared at this location. So the correct response in the secondary task here would be to report the color red. Now, if it is true that attention is directed to the entire target curve, we predict that the probability that the color on this curve is reported correctly is higher than a color that belongs to the distractor curve, because it's well known that if you pay attention to a stimulus, you're much likely to report, or to an object, you're much likely to report features of this object at a later point in time. So we can use this secondary color task kind of as a probe task to probe the distribution of attention across the stimulus during the primary task. Okay, and this slide then shows you the results in the secondary task. It shows you the fraction of correct color reports at the length of this green bar and the fraction of errors at the length of the red bar. So at this segment that belonged to the target curve, performance was about 90 to 95%. In the corresponding segment of the distractor curve, performance was about 40%, so a highly significant difference. Now, if you look at the lower colored segment, you see a similar result. On the target curve, performance is better than on the distractor curve. Now, if you look on the stimulus with a single intersection at the lower position, you can see that nothing much changes. Performance here is better than there. Performance here is better than there. Now, more interesting is what happens if there is a single intersection at the upper position. Here, the target curve performance here is good, but now the target curve crosses over to the other side. You can see that performance crosses over along with it. So again, performance is better on all segments that belong to the target curve. And this shows you a final example. So performance here is better than here, and here performance on the target curve is better than there. So I think this is very good evidence that indeed during this task that requires the detection of connectedness among image components at a psychological level, such an object that needs to be, for which these connectedness relationships need to be established, is labeled with what is called visual attention. So there's a very good correspondence, an almost one-to-one correspondence, between the pattern of rate modulation that we observe in the primary visual cortex and the distribution of visual attention. And I would like to conclude this part of my talk by kind of going over once more over all these pieces of evidence that suggest that we have at least identified one task for which you really need these recurrent connections. First of all, it's difficult to devise an algorithm that solves this task and that does not use recurrent connections. Second, I've indicated that during this task, neurons are influenced from outside the classical receptive field. They convey different messages at different times. And finally, information processing is not over by the time that the first sweep of information reaches the highest levels of the visual cortex. Okay, thank you. Yeah. What I would like to do in the second part of my talk is to generalize from this idea of how perceptual grouping is achieved, to think of perceptual grouping if you not only consider connectedness detection, but also other features that are represented in other areas. So in the beginning of this part of my talk, I will try to outline kind of a scheme of how this might be achieved, trying to generalize these ideas that I have expressed during the first part of my talk. And then later I will also show again some physiological data that will relate to how more complicated cognitive operations might be implemented by what is sometimes called a visual routine. And it should become clear what I mean by a visual routine in just a moment. So what I would like to suggest is that what I talked about in the first part of my talk could be conceived of as a general recipe for grouping. Now, what are the ingredients of our recipe? When an image appears for the first time, the first thing that happens is that some neurons are activated by the image and other neurons are not. And this is what I call, and this is in accordance with Shimon Ullman, and in a very influential paper by him in 1984. So this is what Ullman called the base representation. Now, there are label-spreading connections between those neurons, but I suggested that only a subset of these label-spreading connections is enabled. So this is then what I called the interaction skeleton. And note that neurons that belong to the same perceptual group are linked by the interaction skeleton. However, at this point in time, this linking is only implicit. Nobody can see these connections. In order to make these connections visible, a label has to be spread. And so that is the third ingredient. And during this label spreading, these groupings are made explicit. So now you can go down, look in V1, and see which of the neurons belong to one of these connected components. So now the idea is to try to generalize from these ingredients to think of grouping in also in other feature domains. And so now I won't only be talking about connectedness detection in V1, although I'm not thinking that the only area involved in connectedness detection is V1. But I also would like to consider in features that are connected in other areas, such as shape or color or disparity. Well, disparity is also in. Yes.
Although if you, in terms of the activity, all the active pixels are identical, so why would the label start spreading from all
Yeah, the question is why is the label starting here and not here or at all at the same time? Yeah. Well, obviously, if you spread the label everywhere at the same time, then you lose the value of the label.
So because the
yes, that's a good question. So in the curve tracing task that I presented, this was always the fixation point.
Yeah, okay.
So it could be, in that case, it could be a good idea to start at the fixation point. But in other tasks, and I will come to that, it might be a good idea to start somewhere else. Of course, it's not a good idea to start everywhere at the same time. So if you want to know which parts of the image are connected to each other, you should only do it for one image component at a time. And so the question of how this is coordinated, if there are multiple objects, as in this one slide that it showed in the first part of my talk, that's a good question. And I don't have an immediate and good answer for you. But I will show you some partial answer to this question in the remainder of my talk. Yes? Okay, so let's now try to generalize this general scheme for grouping them to other feature dimensions. And if we have multiple areas, then if we also include neurons that are tuned to motion direction, like in the parietal cortex, and neurons that are tuned to the shape of visual objects, like in the inferotemporal cortex, we have to rethink what we would like to call the Bayes representation. And in an analogy with what I talked about in the first part of my talk, I would like to call the Bayes representation as those neurons that are activated during this first feedforward sweep of activity. And so these are the computations that are primarily carried by these feedforward connections. And I think there is good evidence, although perhaps not conclusive evidence, that you might identify what is computed during this first feedforward sweep that is rapidly sweeping through all these cortical areas, rapidly activating neurons everywhere, that is to identify this with what psychologists call pre-attentive vision. Now, not everything that is of interest to the observer is computed during this feedforward sweep. One example was the establishment of these connectedness relationships. And for that, we need something more, recurrent processing. And this is what Shimon Ullman called the incremental representation. And I would like to argue that what is added are these labeling operations. And this corresponds then to what psychologists call attentive vision. And what I would like to do now is first to discuss some properties of the Bayes representation if we also consider all these other areas beyond V1, and then think of how we can kind of extend this algorithm that I presented during the first part of my talk if we also have all these other features present in our Bayes representation. So one thing that is of interest then if you consider the Bayes representation is information about timing. So the first thing that I would like to show you is how this sweep of activity kind of sweeps through the visual cortex, starting in V1 and reaching all the other areas. And in order to get information about this, I recently carried out a meta-analysis of visual latencies in many areas from very many different studies. And these are compiled in the next few slides. So if you present a new image, then the first areas to respond are the primary visual cortex. You may note also area MT, where neurons also start to respond within 40 milliseconds. So this may be related to this parallel route that goes through the pulvinar, although I'm not sure whether it's known how exactly these earliest responses in area MT are driven. So area MT is an area involved in motion detection. And then 10 milliseconds later, so within 50 milliseconds, there are neurons in V3 and in area 7A, and notably also an area in the frontal cortex, so soon, the frontal eye fields. And then again 50 milliseconds later, you see that now a large portion of the visual cortex is already lighting up, area V2, V4. These are areas like LIP and VIP, so areas in the interparietal sulcus. Some additional areas in the inferotemporal cortex. notably even the prefrontal cortex is activated so soon, premotor cortex and supplementary eye fields. Okay, then again 50 milliseconds later you see activity in the inferotemporal cortex and also in the orbitofrontal cortex. And within 115 milliseconds, all the areas from which I was able to get latency information have started to fire. At least the earliest neurons in all these areas have started to fire. This is area 5 in the area primary motor cortex, area M1, and also the latecomers of the inferotemporal cortex. And I've already indicated that during this first feedforward sweep, there are remarkably complex features extracted from the visual input. So I'll show you an example of a neuron that is selective to something as complicated as a face. And I would like to argue that you can conceive of the activity of these neurons as what I would like to call base grouping. So the activity of a neuron that is tuned to such a complicated constellation of features kind of groups together all these features that make up the pattern. And you can make a similar argument, for instance, if you record from parietal cortex, where there are motion-sensitive areas, to this area MST, and there you find neurons that are tuned to complicated patterns of motion, like in this example, a rotating and contracting flow field. And also these neurons are tuned to such complex patterns from the first spike on. So I would also like to include such motion patterns in what I would like, what I call the base representation. And note that a neuron activated by such a motion pattern also implicitly groups together all these component motions into a coherent pattern motion. Now, we can now briefly discuss the binding problem, but I'm sure you all are familiar with that. So it's unlikely that there are neurons in the cortex that are tuned to, say, a face, a particular color combination that is also rotating and contracting at the same time. There are just too many of these arbitrary configurations. And I already discussed that it's unlikely that there are neurons that are tuned to paths in the image of arbitrary shape during the first part of my talk. And this binding problem also occurs if you consider feature combinations of very simple features, such as a combination of a shape, a color. P refers to position, D to disparity, so a position, a disparity, and a motion direction. There are just too many combinations. And we all know that. So this is then the combinatorial explosion. We all know that such complicated stimuli are represented by distributed patterns of activity. And this is hypothetical imaging data that I composed myself. And so if we present an image such as this one, we will see that our neurons in like retinotopic areas that are activated by the image, some neurons may be selective to the color and shape. Other neurons may be selective to the pattern of motion and so on. And so as long as there is a single object in the image, everything is fine. There's no problem. Now, if you present something else, of course, there will be slightly different clusters of neurons activated. But the binding problem occurs if there are two objects at the same time, because you get the superimposition of the two activation patterns. And it's not necessarily clear anymore which of the two shapes belong to which of the two positions. Okay, well, this is kind of old news. And it would be very convenient if there would be kind of a label in the visual cortex that would kind of identify all those neurons responding to features of one of the objects and distinguish those from neurons that respond to features of the other objects. Now, on the basis of my first talk, I guess you can predict what I will propose. So I will propose that this label is actually an enhancement of neuronal firing rates. And I'm not the first to propose that. So basically, this is an implementation of Treisman's feature integration theory. So she also suggested that if you integrate all these elementary features into a coherent representation, you pay attention to that, and we all know that, or it's very likely that attention is associated with an enhancement of neuronal firing rates. Yes?
So the visual binding is important, but there's also the issue of segmentation. Now, if you are just talking about elimination of firing rate, you will not be able to carry out the segmentation task. If you talk about let's say what Charlie Gray or Singer used to talk about, maybe about synchrony, then it is appearing also the point of mutation.
Yes. I agree. So the advantage of if you have synchrony is that you can have two or even more assemblies that are out of phase and that coexist at the same time. Mm-hmm. Now, the disadvantage of this rate enhancement is that you can only get a single incremental grouping at a time. So if you try to insert this label in two assemblies at the same time, the things that belong to the different objects are not necessarily depends on how it's thread out, but are more likely to be confused. And actually, there is some psychophysical data for that. So if two objects that are within what's sometimes called the focus of attention, now I'm not always talking about a focus, I don't want to say that it's always a focus of attention, because if you have two curves, it's not possible to have a focus selectively on one curve. But in some experiments, they had something like a spatial attention, and they found that the probability of things inside the focus of attention to be confused is larger than things that are on both sides of the focus, so one in the focus, one out of focus, whereas the probability of confusing items outside the focus was again enhanced. So it might well be the case that we have only a single label at our disposal. But of course, that's an issue that's open to further exploration. So of course, this is all nice, but how do you do it? And I would like also then to try to generalize from this idea about these label spreading connections and try to see how this might work out if you consider multiple feature dimensions at the same time. Now, what I need for this proposal is neurons that are tuned to more than a single feature at the same time. So I don't need neurons that are tuned to all features at the same time, but pairwise conjunctions for this purpose will suffice. And so I have here five clusters of neurons, say areas. In one area, neurons are tuned to conjunctions of colors and positions. The second area, neurons tuned to conjunctions of color and disparity. Here's shape and position, disparity and motion, and shape and motion. Now, I indicated these label spreading connections. You see that some areas have one feature domain in common. So here, there is color, and here there's color. The idea is then to put label spreading connections between those neurons that have a similar tuning on the feature dimension that two areas have in common. So that's why there are label spreading connections between those red neurons and those red neurons. And this scheme is here reiterated in between all areas. So the conjunctions that are computed here then by these individual neurons, I would then have to call these kind of base groupings. They're driven by bottom-up, that's the idea. Now, what happens then if I present an image, such as this one? Of course, there are some of these base groupings available, or present here, like there is indeed green at position 1 and red at position 2. So this neuron will be shut down, this neuron may remain active, this neuron may remain active, and this neuron will shut down. And on the basis of this rule that the label may only spread among neurons that are activated by the image, this also then disables some of these label spreading connections. And what we in this particular case end up with is that all these neurons that respond to features of the same object are kind of implicitly grouped together. They are linked by the interaction skeleton. But also in this case, this grouping is not explicit. It's not available for some other neurons that might want to read it out. In order to make it available, say if you want to identify the object that is present at position 2, you then have again to inject the rate enhancement here and see how it is propagated through the network. And then, obviously, all those neurons that respond to features of the object present at this position will start to fire. And so this is an example then, if you inject a label on the basis of position, that's an example of queuing the visual system to a particular location and asking the subject to report what is present at that particular cued location. And this experiment has been carried out in monkeys, a famous study by Moran and Desimon. And they indeed find that during this task, neurons that are tuned to the features present at the cued location start to exhibit an enhanced firing rate. And it's also known that neurons that respond to the cued position also have an enhanced firing rate. Now you can use this scheme also in a different way. Suppose you want to know where the object is that is moving to the right. So then you might want to inject this rate enhancement here and see how it propagates. Now eventually, it will also arrive at neurons that encode the position of the object. This is precisely what you do in visual search. You don't know where it is, you know what it is, so, but you have to report the location. And there's also evidence for this in the literature. For instance, in a study by Colazzi et al., they had a monkey doing a visual search, and they found that neurons encoding features of the object that had to be searched for, its shape, are labeled with an enhanced firing rate. And it's also known that this enhanced firing rate eventually also reaches neurons that encode the location of the object that's being searched. For instance, a study by Motta and also a study by Bichot et al., where you see that neurons that encode the retinotopic location of the object that is being searched are eventually labeled by an enhanced firing rate.
Well, you have to know what the label, of course. The label,
excuse me?
You have to first know what needs to be labeled.
What needs to be labeled?
But in the case of a glass, for example, there are these stimulus before the layer.
Yes.
That
exactly. Yes.
And that would really activate some kind of activity, in a higher area.
Yes, something like that. So in the Colazzi experiment, the monkey was indeed cued with a particular shape. Then there was indeed a delay. The monkey saw nothing. So there are neurons in the inferior temporal cortex, but also in the prefrontal cortex, that keep firing during this delay. And then once the image appears, the new image appears, the search image, and in the Colazzi experiment there were actually only two objects. Then these neurons that still encode the object to be remembered may inject then this enhanced firing rate at the correct position in the interaction skeleton. And then you may propagate it through these label spreading connections, and eventually you will also label the location where this object can be found. That's the idea. Yes?
Well, would you agree if there's no distractor, then the object should pop up immediately?
Yes.
Without feedback?
Yeah. So if there's no distractor.
If there's a distractor, then you use this kind of
exactly.
Information. Is that true, though? I mean, if you have phase, right? You know that phase cell responds immediately.
And
put another phase, does that mean that the first spike doesn't have its phase?
I missed that.
I mean, you have phase cell, where you present phase.
Yes.
Then it responds to forward, as you said.
Yeah.
Okay. If you put the distractor along with phase, like in the receptor field.
Yes.
You're suggesting that the neuron doesn't respond correctly at first?
Well, that depends, of course, I said that some phase-selected neurons may be included in what I call the base representation. So what's being computed by these feed-forward connections, that really depends what is left over to be computed during the second phase of attentional labeling. And I don't have a priori bias to say, well, here's the border. And actually, by training, it may even be possible, and there is some psychophysical evidence for that, that more will be included in the base representation. More things might be by training computed by using bottom-up connections. So I don't have any strong bias to say these things are to be computed bottom-up and these things are not to be computed bottom-up. I think the connectedness problem is something that is very inconvenient if you try to solve it bottom-up. But for specific configurations, it might be computed bottom-up. So there's not a clear boundary a priori.
Can also be done as just a few before.
Excuse me?
A binding.
Yes.
If you just draw an outline that plays, right? You know you bind.
Yes.
The binds, the energy become a phase.
Yeah.
Even though there's other features that you're checking, you still can.
Yes.
But in that case, it's not necessarily true that you're actually going back and.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I would call a base grouping. But I'm just saying that you don't have to. You don't have enough neurons to solve all problems at the same time. So there will always be some leftovers, and these conjunctures need to be computed in a recurrent way. For instance, by these label spreading algorithms. That's the idea. Okay, now. What happens then so this is the image that I've just shown before. What happens now if I take the same features but in a slightly different combination This implies that some of these pairwise conjunctions are no longer there. So now, here we had read at disparity 2, now we have read at disparity 1, so this neuron will be inactivated, this neuron will be activated. Another example is here. Here we had a triangle at position 2, now we have a triangle at position 1. So some of the neurons will be switched in the base representation, and this has a consequence for the pattern of enabled connections. You can see now that, again, the neurons that respond to those features that belong to a single object are still implicitly grouped together by the interaction skeleton. Now if we want to identify the object at position 2, we might then, as I already said, inject the enhanced activity label here. If we do the same thing for this image, it again will spread to precisely those neurons that respond to features that belong to a single object. So this is then a possibility how to do these incremental groupings. So I think this is then just what I wanted to say about how you might try to generalize these ideas if you include neurons that are tuned to other features and that are presented in other areas. So now I would like to go to physiology and see how this works out if you record from neurons during tasks that require the monkey to consider other features. And I've just indicated how you can use the interaction skeleton to identify an object at a cute location. I've indicated how you can use it to do a visual search for a particular shape. And I've indicated how you can use the interaction skeleton ideas to do a connectedness detection. Now let's see how all these things come together during perception. So now I would like to discuss what is sometimes called a visual routine. And this is also a term that was introduced by Simon Ullmann in a paper in 1984. And this is my favorite example of what might be solved by a visual routine. So suppose that you're driving your car and that you've just passed a church. Now you're looking down on this map because you want to know where you end up if you follow this road. And the first thing to do, of course, is then to look for the location of this church on your map. Once you've found it, you might want to trace along this road and to identify objects alongside this road to see where you will end up if you follow this road. And in this 1984 paper, Simon Ullmann suggested that such a complicated cognitive operation might be solved by what he called a visual routine. And he suggested that a visual routine can usually be decomposed in a number of what he called elemental operations. Now, in this particular task, you would need first the visual search operation to locate the church. The second operation that you would need would be a curve tracing operation. And the third operation that you would need would be an identification. And the idea then of Ullmann was that if you have kind of a limited library of these elemental operations, you can always compile from these because you can use them in different sequences, an almost arbitrary number of what he called visual routines. So they are kind of what he called the instruction set of the visual brain. That's the underlying idea. Now, how would such an algorithm look like in early visual areas like the primary visual cortex? Okay, well, this would be simplified representation of what I call the base representation. So in early visual areas, there will be neurons that respond to one of the objects, there will be neurons that respond to segments of one of the curves, and so on. Now, as I indicated, the first elemental operation that we need here is a visual search. And I also already indicated that during visual search, eventually, the location of the object that needs to be found is labeled in retinotopic areas by an enhancement of neural firing rates. Then, of course, such an enhancement provides the ideal starting position for the subsequent curve tracing operation, which, as we have seen, is also associated with... Yes? Okay. We have seen that it's also associated with an enhancement of neuronal responses along the curve. Yeah.
So this is some sort of retinotopic.
Yes, this is just a retinotopic map. And I just indicate a number of neurons or the receptor field of a number of neurons in this map.
So why would a church neuron be located near
a road neuron? This is not necessarily a church neuron. This is just a neuron with a receptor field that happens to fall on a church. But it might well be a vertical neuron in retinal topic areas, you don't have neurons that are tuned to very complicated shapes.
Okay, so I should not be thinking of what you were talking about 5 minutes ago, where you had some neurons that like connect.
Yes, these neurons are typically situated in higher areas, like inferior temporal cortex, where receptive fields are very large. So these are not retinal topic areas. In retinal topic areas, you have some rudimentary shape selectivity, and some, I mean, also how where it ends, the shape selectivity in these early visual areas is not settled. So there is data from the lab of Van Essen who suggests that you actually can also get relatively complicated shape tuning in area V1. But I think everybody agrees that the type of tuning regarding shape that you get in early visual areas is much less advanced than the type of shape tuning that you get in areas where receptive fields are very large and that are not very topic. But that's not really the point. For my scheme, it just suffices if the location of the object needs to be defined is eventually labeled with an enhancement of neuronal responses. Okay, and then the idea is then that this is then the starting position for the subsequent curve tracing operation. And now to identify objects alongside the road, you might then start by labeling these objects, because it's also known that to identify an object at a cued location, these neurons will also enhance their firing rate, also in retinal topic areas. So if this is all true, then it should be possible to monitor the progression of such a visual routine by recording in the primary visual cortex. Now, to get at that, we trained monkeys. Already said that the label that is being spread is presumably an enhanced firing rate. So to get at that, we trained monkeys on two tasks. The first task is the same task that I have already outlined. It's just a curve tracing task. So fixation point, two curves, two circles, and now the monkey has to make an eye movement to the circle that is connected to the fixation point. So this task can be solved by a single elemental operation, a curve tracing operation. And the second task is somewhat more complex. And trials in this more complex task started with a gray fixation point, and then a stimulus appeared on the screen that looked like this. And you can see that there were, again, two curves, two circles. And at the same time that the stimulus appeared, the fixation point changed color. And it changed color to either blue or yellow. Now, the color of the fixation point was a cue for the monkey, because this was a color that he had to search for in the display, because it marked the beginning of the target curve. So once he had found this blue marker, he had to trace the target curve to its other end. And then at the end of the trial, so this was all done presumably while he was still fixating here. And at the end of the trial, the fixation point was removed from the screen, and now the monkey was allowed to make a single eye movement to the gray circle at the other end of the target curve. So this task can be solved by a sequence of two elemental operations. The first operation being a search for a colored marker, followed by a curve tracing operation. Okay, this shows you an example of a response during this task from a group of neurons in area V1. During a simple task. So again, here receptive field was on the target curve, here it was on the destructor curve, and we've seen this before, response was stronger, which is the yellow response, if the receptive field was on the target curve. Now, I wanted to know what the latency of this modulation was. So here, I subtracted the two responses from each other, and I fitted a sigmoid to the response difference. And I took the inflection point of the sigmoid as a measure for the latency of modulation. In this particular case, this was in 56 milliseconds. Now, the same neuron, but during the complex task. So here the receptive field is on the target curve. That starts with the blue marker. And here the receptive field is on the destructor curve, because here the target curve starts with the yellow marker. Again, the response was strongest when the receptive field was on the target curve. But you can see that the latency modulation, according to my measure, was much delayed by about 150 milliseconds. So I would like to argue then that this 150 milliseconds presumably reflects the time required first to do this visual search operation. Now, these effects were also seen at the population level. So this shows you population response across 34 recording sites in area V1 of two monkeys. And this shows you responses during the simple task that could be solved by just curve tracing, and we see a response enhancement at a latency of 135 milliseconds. And here during the complex task, and here modulation occurred about 140 milliseconds later. So this is summarized in this slide. So during curve phrasing, we see an enhancement along the target curve, according to my measure, at a latency of about 135 milliseconds. During the complex task, this labeling of the target curve also occurs, but about 140 milliseconds later, presumably because this visual search operation has first to be carried out. Now, on the basis of previous studies, I kind of predicted that during visual search for a particular color, say the color blue, that then the locations that contain this color that the monkey is looking for are labeled with an enhanced firing rate. This locus of an enhanced firing rate would, of course, provide the ideal starting position for the subsequent curve tracing operation. And I would suggest then that this takes about 140 milliseconds. But of course, this is very indirect evidence of what's happening during this visual search. So to get a more direct measure of what happens during visual search in area V1, we made a slight modification of our task by introducing an irrelevant colored segment in the stimulus. So this segment in the stimulus is completely irrelevant for the task. But it could have the color that the monkey was looking for, this is the case here, or it could have the opposite color. So here the monkey is looking for blue, but the segment in the receptor field happens to be yellow. And we predicted then that responses should be stronger if the color in the receptor field matches the color that the monkey is looking for compared to a situation in which there is a mismatch. And this shows you an example of this effect. It was significant, but you may see, so the response was stronger when the receptor field contained the color that the monkey was looking for. You can also see that these effects are not as robust as we typically observe during curve tracing. And this was also true at the population level. So we only got 8 recording sites where the effect was significant out of a total of 28 recording sites. But I would like to emphasize that all these 8 recording sites went in the same direction. That is, at these recording sites, the response was stronger when the color in the receptor field matched the color that the monkey was looking for. And this then shows you a selective population average of these 8 recording sites. And you can see then, at the population level, we observe a latency of modulation of about 150 milliseconds. So we now also have a more complete picture of the complex task. So during visual search, it's indeed the case that those locations in the visual field that contain the color that the monkey is looking for are labeled with enhanced neuronal response, which of course provides the ideal starting position for a subsequent curve tracing operation. So it indeed seems to be the case that it's possible to monitor the progression of such a visual routine by recording activity in early visual areas, such as the primary visual cortex. Now there's one possible problem. If you think that these early visual areas are really important for the execution of these visual routines, and that problem is related to eye movements. So suppose that our subject is foveating here, and he has labeled this curve, and we have seen that sometimes this can take up to 200 to 300 milliseconds. Now, subjects, monkeys and humans too, make eye movements about 3 times each second. Now, what happens during an eye movement is illustrated here. So now our subject has made an eye movement to the tent, and this implies that the receptive fields are now displaced from the curve. And of course, this will render rate modulations that are expressed by these neurons completely worthless. Of course, these receptive fields will be replaced by others, belong to other neurons, but of course it would be very inconvenient for the progression of such a visual routine if we would have to wait for another 200 to 300 milliseconds before these neurons started to express the modulation. Now, there might be a way to solve this problem. Perhaps there are some higher visual areas that are less influenced by the consequences of an eye movement, that kind of temporarily store the pattern of rate modulations and that then rapidly feed back to the primary visual cortex after each saccade. So if that is the case, we would expect then an earlier modulation if a receptive field is brought onto a curve and the animal already knows whether it's one of the curves that needs to be labeled. But it's the question that we wanted to address in a physiological study. Yes, so that's. I just want to look at the physiology now. If there's is there such a mechanism that kind of rescues the pattern of rate modulation from one fixation to the next? Okay, so and this is shows how we kind of investigated this. So we now have monkeys making 2 eye movements along a target curve. So the monkey is fixating here, then the stimulus appears on the screen in its entirety. So the whole thing appears, of course not this green rectangle, at once. And then the monkey has to make two eye movements along the target curve. So his first eye movement will be directed here, and his second eye movement will be directed here. For this stimulus, he will first be fixating here, the stimulus appears, his first eye movement will go here, the second eye movement will go here. Now, we have good evidence, both physiologically and psychophysically, that while the monkey is still fixating here, and we have him fixate here for 500 milliseconds or so, that he's actually already mentally tracing the entire curve. So while he's fixating here, he really analyzes also this segment, although it's only relevant for his second eye movement from now. Okay? So this implies then that if you have a receptive field here on the blank screen, then the first eye movement will bring this receptive field onto a curve, and the monkey already knows that this is the target curve.
You know, so the saccade can be anticipated, you know, it's going to move.
Yeah, so what happens is the... Yes, so the whole stimulus appears at once. The monkey can start mentally tracing from here to here and from here to here, while he's fixating here. And we have very good evidence, so we already see modulation along this curve while the monkey is still fixating here. And we also see it reflected in reaction times. So we really know that he is tracing along the entire curve while he's just foveating here. Although it is not... He seems that he's planning two eye movements in advance. Although there's not really a good reason for the monkey to plan two eye movements in advance, because he will still be looking at the same stimulus when he has made his first eye movement. But the reaction time suggests, and also physiology suggests, indeed this is what's happening. While he's fixating here, he's kind of mentally tracing the entire thing. But this implies then that if there is a receptive field here on the blank screen, that this first eye movement will bring this receptive field onto a curve, and the monkey already knows that this is the target curve. And here, the receptive field due to the same eye movement will bring the receptive field onto a curve, and here the monkey already knows that it's going to be the distractor curve. So if there is any information being stored from one fixation to the next, then we expect modulation to occur here at an earlier point in time. Now we actually compared these normal trials to a second type of trials in which we played a trick on the monkeys. And these were the catch trials, and we played a trick because while the monkeys were making their first eye movement, we actually switched connections here. Now, when you are making an eye movement, you are not really sensitive to all these transients that appear in the stimulus. And but this implies that here the receptive field will fall on a curve. The monkey expects this to be the target curve, but it unexpectedly has changed into a distractor curve. And here's the opposite situation. So here the receptive field falls on the curve, the monkey expects this to be the distractor curve, but it unexpectedly changed into a target curve. So if there is any information being stored from one fixation to the next, it can only work against the monkeys on these catch trials. Okay, this shows you then an example of such a recording in area V1. So in yellow, the receptive field is brought on the curve. The monkey already knows that this is going to be the target curve, and it doesn't change. Here the receptive field falls on the curve. The monkey can already know that it's the distractor curve, and it doesn't change. And indeed, we see an enhancement when the receptive field falls on the curve, and the monkey can already know that it's the target curve. But now the modulation occurs about 60 milliseconds earlier than we typically observe during curve tracing when the stimulus appears de novo on the screen. Yes? That's a very good question. So what is time zero? So, of course, this will depend on the trajectory of the eye during the first eye movement, the timing of the first eye movement, and also the extent of the receptive field. So we wanted to be very conservative here. So what we did is we took the borders of the receptive field as measured by moving light bars, and measured the first time. And we also took in account the eye trajectory on all these individual trials. And on each trial, we measured the first time that any part of this square that we defined to be the receptive field came in contact with any pixel of this curve. So this was done on a trial-by-trial basis. So we defined the time zero on a trial-by-trial basis in that way. Okay, but in this case it's not that important because I'm going to compare it to catch trials. And this shows you the response during catch trials. So here in red, the receptive field falls on the curve. The monkey expects this to be the target curve, but it unexpectedly changed during the first eye movement into a distractor curve. What you see is a brief episode of a relative response enhancement that changes then later into a relative suppression. Here, in yellow, the receptive field falls on the curve. The monkey expects this to be the distractor curve, but it unexpectedly changes into a target curve. Then you see a brief episode of suppression changing into a relative response enhancement. So what you see here is an episode of paradoxical modulation that reflects the stimulus from before first saccade. And then, after an additional delay of about, in this case, 70 milliseconds, the responses start to reflect the new stimulus configuration after the change was made to the stimulus. So this really, taken together, these data really indicate that there indeed seems to be such a mechanism that kind of rescues the pattern of rate modulations across eye movements and perhaps some higher visual area that rapidly feeds back to the primary visual cortex to rapidly restore these rate modulations. And I would therefore argue that the progression of such a visual routine need not be as severely affected by eye movements as you might think as would occur if such a mechanism would not exist. Now I change to again a slightly different subject, because and this is also the final part of my talk, in which I want to answer the question: is how is this pattern of rate modulation that you observe in visual in area view one related to the monkey's interpretation? And we wanted to investigate it experimentally, and the approach is the following. Suppose that I'm going to show this image to a human subject on a large number of trials, say 100 trials. And suppose that he's doing it correctly in, say, 80 trials. So on these trials, he will tell me that if he follows this road, he will end up at this camping site. But now suppose that on 20 trials, for some reason, he makes an error here. And on these trials, he will report to me that he will end up at this pile of stones. Now, if this is the case, then this is a very convenient situation, because I can now study the brain activity of this subject and compare it between two situations. In these situations, the stimulus is absolutely identical, but his interpretation of the stimulus was different. And this is what we wanted to do in our monkeys, to distinguish between two possible models of how these pattern of rate modulations relates to the interpretation of the animal. The first model states that this pattern of labeling that you observe in area V1 is due to an autonomous process that is independent of the monkey's interpretation. So even if he makes an error, the label in area V1 will still be the same. And if an error is made, it's not made in V1, but it's made in perhaps some higher visual area that looks down on V1 and tries to make sense of this pattern of rate modulations. And the second model, that is perhaps a bit more interesting, suggests that these rate modulations actually reflect the monkey's interpretation. So if the monkey makes an error, the pattern of labeling is also erroneous. And in this, and also note that these two models have different predictions regarding those segments that are behind the location where the error is made. So both models predict that before the error is made, labeling is unchanged by an error, but only behind the location where the error is made. This model predicts that nothing changes, and this model predicts that the pattern of labeling will change. And so we now want to our monkeys to make errors during this task, and this shows how we did that. So we had stimuli with non-intersections and stimuli with intersections. So in this particular case, the monkey would have to go to the left target with his eyes, and he did so in about 100% of trials. And in this stimulus, when there is an intersection, he should go to the right target for an eye movement. And indeed, he did so. That is, he went to the left target in about 0% of trials. Now, you can have a non-intersection look more like an intersection to make it more difficult by reducing the size of the gap between the two curves. And this is what we did. And indeed, at some point, the monkey starts to make errors, as if on a fraction of trials, he takes this to be an intersection instead of a non-intersection. You can do the same thing with the intersections, by having the two curves intersect at a shallower angle. And at some point, the monkey indeed starts to make errors. Now, these erroneous trials then provide us with the opportunity to compare the activity in area V1 between a situation that the stimulus is exactly the same, but in one case, the monkey interprets in one way, and in another case, in another trial, he interprets the very same stimulus in a different way. So this is what we set out to do, and this shows you an example of this. So the green rectangle shows you the receptive field of a group of neurons in V1. Here it's on the target curve. This shows you this is the yellow response. And here it's on the distractor curve, which is the red response. And, we already have seen that. But now, in the lower panel, I'm showing you erroneous trials with this stimulus configuration. So this stimulus configuration gave rise to a response enhancement on correct trials, yellow curve. But you can see by the dashed yellow curve here that it now changed into a relative response suppression. And this is clearly consistent with the erroneous interpretation, because I would like to argue that the monkey presumably took this non-intersection for an intersection. And in this interpretation, then, the receptive field would be laying on the distractor curve. Another example of this effect, so the same cell, so the same data in the upper row here, but now I'm showing you erroneous trials with this configuration. So on correct trials with this configuration, we saw the relative response suppression, but you can see that on erroneous trials, it's changed into a relative enhancement. Now again, presumably the monkey was thinking that this was an intersection, and in his erroneous interpretation, indeed, the receptive field would be laying on a segment of the target curve. No, I did not. But here, the receptive field happens to fall also on the target for an eye movement. I also observed the effect if receptive fields are just behind the location where the two curves come close together. Second example of this effect. Now the receptive field is on a segment before the location where the error is made. So here the receptive field is on the target curve, and actually this counted as an intersection. You can see that it can become relatively hard. So the monkey should take this as an intersection. So this is the correct target for an eye movement. Here the receptive field is on the distractor curve. And I'm showing in the lower panel, so again the response is stronger when the receptive field is on the target curve. And in the lower panel, I'm showing you the responses to this configuration, but now on erroneous trials. So on these erroneous trials, the monkey took this as a non-intersection. And on correct trials, you saw that with this configuration, you saw a response enhancement. But you can see that on incorrect trials, this enhancement is maintained. Now, actually, this is still consistent with the erroneous interpretation, because here the receptive field is before the location where the error is made. So presumably, in this erroneous interpretation, the target curve would look something like this. But the receptive field would still be laying on the target curve. So this data is then summarized here. We can now reject the model that suggests that this pattern of activity that you observe in the primary visual cortex during curve tracing is due to an autonomous process. Now instead, it really seems to reflect the interpretation of the monkey, and it even tells you the location where the monkey makes an error. Because before this location, the response modulation is unchanged, and only after this location, it is changed by the error that the monkey is committing. Okay, now I come to my conclusions. I've suggested that it's convenient to think of what might be called the base representation as the consequence of this feedforward sweep of activity that is propagated through all visual areas. Then there are some connections between the neurons that are activated during this first feedforward sweep, and I call that the interaction skeleton. And you can then compute additional groupings, incremental groupings, by spreading a rate enhancement through this interaction skeleton, this subset of enabled connections in the base representation. Then, if you have all this stuff in place, you can really solve relatively difficult cognitive problems by what is sometimes called a visual routine. You can think of a visual routine as being composed of a sequence of more simple elemental cognitive operations. Now you can monitor the progression, for this one, these elemental operations such as visual search, curve tracing, and also identification at the acute location are associated with rate modulations in visual areas, including area V1. And you can therefore monitor the progression of such a visual routine by recording in early visual areas, such as area V1. Now, after an eye movement, these rate modulations are rapidly reestablished. So eye movements are not as detrimental to the progression of such a visual routine as you might anticipate. And moreover, the activity in area V1, in some cases, really seems to reflect the interpretation of the monkey of a visual stimulus. Thank you. Yes.
I think that the 2 years ago in the epoch of Rolfinger showed similar problem. Not remember this. He had a figure with many horses or zebra that look very similar. And he suggests another mechanism. I don't remember if you were a participant in this work or not, but what can you say about the shift, or maybe not shift, your interpretation of the relationship of the binding problem during the last 10 years?
Yeah. So, I mean, the reason that I was started to be interested in curve tracing and that I started to explore that is that I wanted to see, which was a clear prediction of what I thought at that time, and I was a collaborator of Singer, that if it is true that all those parts of a single coherent object are labeled by synchrony, then I should see synchrony during this task. And I thought it would be nice, a nice aspect of this task is that it now can correlate the pattern of synchrony to the behavioral response. So what I actually showed in terms of rate modulations, I actually predicted for myself that it should be true for synchrony. So if the monkey makes an error, then I should see synchrony between erroneous segments. And so the pattern of synchrony should be changed by errors. Now, when I mean, and that's also the reason that I always recorded from multiple sites at the same time to look at synchrony. And what comes out of this is that the story is a bit complicated. That I would like to distinguish between the type of synchrony that we typically studied in Frankfurt, which is relatively precise. So if you see the peaks in the cross-correlation functions, you typically get a width of perhaps 10, 15 milliseconds. And this type of synchrony is known to decay very rapidly with cortical distance. So, if you have non-overlapping receptive fields, then the probability of finding that synchrony is much reduced. And so in my curve tracing tasks, receptive fields are sometimes separated by 5 degrees or 10 degrees, so you can kind of fit like perhaps 8 receptive fields in between. So you just don't see this fast type of synchrony across these cortical distances. And this is, I found that, but you could have anticipated this on earlier work by Eckhorn and also by Gray and Singer, Andreas Engel. So it just isn't there. Now, if you define a second type of synchrony to be synchrony with peaks that have a width of, say, 50 to 100 milliseconds, they also occur, and they don't fall off so rapidly with cortical distance. So I do see these broad peaks between neurons that are at the beginning of a curve and at the end of a curve. They really occur. But they seem to be completely unrelated to the perceptual organization. So these peaks are as strong for two receptive fields that are on different curves as they are for two receptive fields that are on the same curve. And I therefore see no use for these broad correlation peaks to solve segmentation problems. And yeah, I do see these rate modulations. So to my own surprise, I saw them. I mean, I was expecting to see synchrony, but I saw that it was an enhancement of firing rates. So I think that's what we have to live with.
I'm curious, I wanted to understand how during the saccade, you say something of this rate enhancement transported to other neurons.
Yes. Yes.
But as far as I understood you, then this enabled connectivity should be transported because the basal connectivity still has to come, right?
Yes, exactly.
The idea is that really that having some established, whatever, skeleton
you call it, this skeleton will be doing its account transported somewhere else.
No. No, that would be not how I think it is. Maybe that's the way I said it, but the mechanism could be as follows. So of course, if you think of this interaction skeleton in early visual areas, the pattern of enabled connections, those connections that are between neurons are actually activated by the image. This collapses, of course, immediately, because those neurons that had been in the base representation are not longer in the base representation anymore. So of course, there are other neurons that come into the base representation. They have immediately the interaction skeleton between them. There's no need for any transportation. These connections, these neurons are now active. So in principle, these connections between those neurons may now start to spread the label. But the question is, how can I make sure that it doesn't take, again, 200 to 300 milliseconds that these neurons spread the label? Now, consider a neuron, for instance, in area IT, that is sensitive to the global shape of a curve. Such a neuron may remain active across the saccade. There's no need for this cell to change its activity because it has a large receptive field that fell on the curve before and still falls on the curve after the saccade. So such a neuron may rapidly then feedback, maybe through intermediate neurons that are kind of not as sensitive to the global shape, but a bit sensitive to global shape. You kind of have to invert this computation that gives you translational invariance to go back to those cells that actually give input to the neuron in IT, but that are now different cells. So such a mechanism might help to rapidly reestablish rate modulations at the earlier levels, but there's no need to really transport connectivity. And another possible mechanism is you have neurons in the parietal cortex that have their receptive field not in retinal coordinates, but in head-centered coordinates. So if you move your eyes, these neurons don't change their receptive field. So if such a neuron is labeled, it may still be labeled after the saccade. There's no need for this neuron to change its activity. So also such a neuron, taking into account the new eye movement or correlatory signal, or the new eye position, may then perhaps rapidly feedback to those neurons that are now at the correct retinotopic position. So that's so I think there are a number of papers by Anderson and Zipser about this, how you can go from a retinotopic representation to a representation in head coordinates. You can use the same mechanisms in the opposite direction to go from a head-centered representation to a retinotopic representation. So
it means that the feedback connection can be very quite precise.
Yes, I think that you can get away by just saying that only those connections that are between neurons that are really activated by the image do the job. Of course, if you change the retinotopic representation, you will switch off a lot of connections because all these neurons will stop firing. Of course, now other neurons start firing, so this enables other connections. And I haven't modeled it or anything, but I could imagine that this new set of connections that is enabled just in the opposite direction can perhaps rapidly restore the pattern of rate modulation in retinotopic areas.
So the idea is you have some higher level neuron active, some new neurons on the lower level.
Exactly, yes.
They somehow feed to this higher level, and these connections, so to say, the forward connections,
yes,
feedback.
Well, they're matched by feedback connections,
so
yes.
Connectivity and
throwing
away most of it, because all those who potentially drive it can be taken for feedback.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not saying that I know the exact mechanisms, but there might be something interestingly from a computational point of view to look at that.
I have another question. What do you think is the physiological basis of this establishing the enabling connections?
you want to know about synaptic physiology and how these interactions take place? Well, you could think of a mechanism, and actually there is some evidence for let's say a lateral connection that only influences the postsynaptic neuron if it's activated by the image. So suppose that you have a neuron here sitting and firing at 10 spikes per second, or perhaps 50 spikes per second, and another neuron here firing at 50 spikes per second. Now, if this neuron, if there's a connection between those neurons, then this lateral connection, by somehow kind of interacts with the bottom-up input to have a larger effect on this neuron if it's driven, to have virtually no effect on the neuron if it's just not stimulated. Now, I don't know about any ideas of how this might work synaptically, but there's a lot of physiological evidence that this is actually the case. So if you look at these contextual effects that have been described, so say a horizontal bar that pops out in the region of vertical bars, such a neuron, these lateral effects, so such a neuron will fire more strongly than if this same bar is in a field of all horizontal bars. So that in those two situations, the receptor field stimulus is the same, but the spatial configuration is different. Now, if there is nothing in the receptor field of this neuron, you don't see any effect. It will just not fire. So these contextual effects that make the difference between a field of vertical bars and a field of horizontal bars, they influence the neuron if there's something in the receptive field. They don't influence the neuron, or hardly influence the neuron, if there's nothing in the receptive field. So, I mean, I don't know how this would work synaptically, but I think there is good physiological evidence for these kind of asymmetric or nonlinear interactions taking place in early visual areas.
But actually, everything I know about synapses and single neurons says the opposite should happen. I mean, the more faster neuron fires, the weaker connections are typically. The higher the firing rate of postsynaptic neuron, the more depressed it is.
Yes.
So, physiologically, it could be a little, I mean, it's an interesting story primarily, but physiologically, it could be a little tough to explain.
Yeah.
I'm not feeling really used to, I mean, for all these the current connections, why cannot we just feel what dance itself?
Yeah, I include top-down connections in to what I call recurrent connections. So I refer to recurrent connections as lateral connections plus top-down connections. Oh, sure. I mean, I don't have any strong evidence that things are done only lateral connections, by only lateral connections. I think there is, personally, I think there is a very important role for top-down here. But of course, in some cases, it may be very difficult to do it purely in a top-down fashion, and that is when curves come very close together. Because these top-down influences, neurons there in higher areas typically have large receptive fields, so they just don't have the required spatial resolution to do this labeling process with sufficient accuracy. So in those cases, if you really have curves that are so close together that only V1 can resolve it, in those cases, I think it would be convenient to do it with lateral connections within area V1. Now, if the curves are a little bit more separate and the V2 receptive field just fits in, then it might be done by lateral connections in V2. If the thing is completely isolated and there's no interfering curves nearby, then it may be done just by a single neuron in area IT. And that would also explain then that in these simple configurations, if this IT neuron would still feed back to V1, that you see the whole curve in V1 in those situations lighting up at once.